Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to be joined by Slate's Dahlia Lithwick to talk about the Trump Supreme Court's latest perfidy. That's a word I enjoy, perfidy. And then we're going to talk to Jonathan Levinson, who is a reporter who covers policing for Oregon Public Broadcasting. And we're going to talk to him about some new details about the really shockingly politicized federal response to racial justice protests under Trump in Portland, Oregon. But first, Space Karen, a.k.a. Elon Musk, has purchased Twitter, and it has been quite a shit show early on. Musk, I mean, it's weird. I was talking to a friend, and I was like, you know, I don't know if I can stay here, if I'm going to go to a new site. And then I realized, well, you know, I got a community built at Facebook where I never go. And he was like, yeah, but Zuckerberg is also like a total, well, the difference maybe is that Musk has become a dedicated troll, right, on his own website. And some advertisers, fearful that the self-proclaimed free speech absolutist, which of course does not apply to his like employees seeking to join a union or complaining about working conditions, they're worried that Musk will unleash a torrent of hate speech. Some of them are fleeing, which must be good news for Elon Musk, who says he hates ads. At least he said that he hated ads before paying around $13 billion more than the market capitalization for Twitter and taking on an enormous amount of debt. And I don't know, did I mention that Twitter has lost money for years? They've posted losses for 10 of the past 12 years. $44 billion he spent. And he spent this, he overpaid to that degree based on a very stupid conspiracy theory that Twitter was censoring conservatives. So now we have Musk reaching out to advertisers and trying to assure them that their ads won't be floating on a river of racism and misogyny and all that. And he's trying to make some money on the side by getting everybody to purchase a blue check mark for $8 a month. By the way, I have a blue check and it is not worth 8 cents a month to me. Just means that I am who I say I am, right? I've never really understood why people like Musk think it's some kind of status symbol. Basically, I uploaded a copy of my driver's license. That was it. Anyway, I think people are right to worry about Space Karen letting the bigots run wild. But I also think a lot of people are overlooking the prospect that he is going to turn Twitter, which, you know, despite having a smaller reach than like Facebook or Google, has outside influence because so many journalists are on there. People aren't focused enough on the prospect that he will turn Twitter into a massive vector for disinformation, right? And I'm not saying that it isn't already that. But he is a wingnut, and disinformation is their currency. Bloomberg reported this week that Musk, and I quote, has frozen some employee access to internal tools used for content moderation and other policy enforcement, curbing the staff's ability to clamp down on misinformation ahead of a major U.S. election. And then Vice reported that Twitter's Trust and Safety Council, which is an advisory board of a bunch of outside groups that make content moderation recommendations, has basically been shoved to the side. According to the report, Twitter personnel are ghosting the board. And by the way, Musk said he's going to put together a board just like that. And some of the board members are like, does he know we exist? Anyway. Misinformation and disinformation is, of course, flooding the zone as we head into the midterms, according to experts. And I guess I should back up here and say that Twitter uses automated tools and third-party contractors to zap posts with, like, the N-word or whatever. And that has not changed. So there has been a spike in those kinds of posts, but since Musk took over, but they are being removed. It is sorting reality from disinformation that requires a human hand and more nuance. And that's not happening, or at least to the degree it was happening, even as voters are being told to go to the wrong polling places at the wrong time, various conspiracy theories about elections being stolen and children being trafficked by shadow elites or whatever are inciting MAGA lunatics to violence, as we saw this past week. All of this is happening. Now, I guess I should circle back to the blue check thing, because what a blue check does is help combat disinformation by bad actors impersonating other accounts, right? The blue check just lets you know, yes, this tweet is from the Washington Post or a climate scientist or an expert in whatever field. And when they're meaningless and a lot of verified people decide they don't want to support this Twitter troll, Elon Musk, it's going to be that much harder to know what is and isn't true. And that is a core goal of today's right-wing movement. Just make it so that it's too confusing for people to sort out reality from nonsense, from propaganda. So we'll see how that plays out. I think a lot of us are taking a wait-and-see approach. Let's see if we're going to get off of that site. In any event, with that, we're going to move on with the show. Let's take a quick break. Stay tuned. We'll come back with Dahlia Lithwick.
It was the time of the preacher, when the story began, of the choice of a lady and the love of a man. How he loved her so dearly, he went out of his mind when she left him for someone that she'd left behind. And he cried like a baby, he screamed like a panther in the middle of the night. And he saddled his pony, and he went for a ride. It was the time of the preacher.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I am very pleased to be joined by Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia is a senior editor at Slate and a contributor to MSNBC. She also hosts the podcast Amicus, and she has a new book out titled Lady Justice, Women, the Law, and the Battle to Save America. Very, very busy person. Dahlia, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. One of the great mysteries of our era is why you don't have a blue check on Twitter.
Well, very weird. Apparently for $20 slash through $8, I can get one. I mean, if we keep bargaining at this rate, they will pay me, I think.
They should be paying you, honestly.
I leave it to David Simon to work this out.
I mean, you are a very well-known journalist and author. I guess you won't have to decide whether to give Space Karen $8 a month like the rest of us. I will never pay a penny for Twitter. You know why? Because I understand I am the product.
You are the product. I mean, here's the other thing in complete candor and disclosure only between me and you. I actually was off Twitter for 10 years and only got back on when my overlords told me that was what I needed to do to sell the book. So I actually have absolute no just credibility or basis from which to complain. In other words, I think, you know, this is like when I complained about my con law 2 grade a year and a half after it was given to me at law school. And my then con law 2 professor was like, yeah, you have a time machine. So I feel very much like I do not get to say, hey, 2013 me is really pissed off. So
I think you can. I'm gonna allow it. I will allow it. Anyway, listen, I just bought your book, and I haven't read it because we're dealing with the midterms and everything, but I am taking next week off, and I am looking forward to reading it.
Well, thank you.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about it?
Yeah. I mean, it was a book that kind of started in 2017, and it was intended to be kind of a, you know, buck up and realize that we won a lot of lawsuits against Donald Trump, and that it's easy to say there was nothing to show for all that. But, you know, I had been covering, as we all had, some of these lawsuits that were just epic, epic losses for the Trump administration. And I wanted to pull them together and say, not just he lost on, you know, this and he lost on that and he lost on this as well, but also to lift up some of the amazing women lawyers who had wrangled those lawsuits, often on their own, often against the advice of, you know, other groups who were telling them they couldn't win. So it started off as a way of saying the law matters. It is a bulwark against fascism and authoritarianism. And deployed correctly, it actually did stand between us and Trumpism in important ways. And then, of course, Dobbs happened the week before I sent in the final manuscript, and it started to feel like maybe the law was both the cause of and solution to all of our problems. And so I had to pivot really quickly in June of this year and rethink that very complicated problem, which is, yes, the law is the thing that has given us dignity and equality and freedom and rights, particularly in the Donald Trump era. It's also the thing that is poised to really, really do great violence to women in this country. Yes. And how do we think about that complicated dual role? And so the book very much started, I almost want to say, as a piece of a history. And it is now, I hope, something of a blueprint to using the law to move forward.
I mean, I just want to know how your perspective shifted on the idea that Trump was losing at the courts, given that he has entrenched Trumpism at the highest court for perhaps a generation to come.
Yeah, for our lifetimes. And I think maybe embedded in your question is the answer, which is he did lose in the courts. He persistently lost. He had the lowest win record of any administration, you know, in modern history. And administrations usually win a lot. They get huge deference. So he lost in the courts, but as you say, he won the court. You know, he took over not just the U.S. Supreme Court, but, you know, the federal appeals courts. And that wasn't a huge success that we ascribe, I think, to Donald Trump. That's where we say he very smartly stepped aside and let Mitch McConnell and Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society and Don McGahn and the army of people who understood, probably better than he did, to be
definitely better than he did.
Yeah, that you can, through minority rule and through, you know, spending a couple billion dollars, win in the courts when you've lost in every sort of electoral and legislative branch. And so I think he, you know, in some sense, this is his great success story, is that he lost all the time. And in the end, he took over the courts.
I want to ask you how the nature of the current 6-3 court, 6-3 Republican majority court, has changed your job. It seems to me that most legal analysis with this court is problematic, given that they have very little regard not only for precedent but also for consistency. Like there is not something that you can really count on from one decision to the next, because it's always kind of achieving whatever they need to achieve a conservative goal, they'll go for.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the question that is roiling the Supreme Court press corps right now, is how much do we persist in covering this institution the way we've been covering it, you know, for decades? And I think that there is a lot of real soul searching going on. You know, I would note that a press corps that has typically, I think, done pretty good work pushing out the court's preferred narrative, which is this is a court and they are brains in vats and balls and strikes and neutral umpires, has moved away from that narrative in the last couple of years. If you think about the beginning of last term, for the first time, the term was opened by a lot of mainstream reporters on the Supreme Court by talking about the popularity and the massive crisis of confidence in the court, and that's persisted this term as well, and the shadow docket. In other words, stuff that the court didn't want us to talk about. I think the press corps has gotten on board with the proposition that, as you say, this is just not a business as usual court. I will say that's somewhat stymied by the way in which we cover the court as a press corps, because we tend to cover cases, right? And so what we say is, oh, here's affirmative action, the biggest case of the year. And we cover it as though it's a case and that there's this presumptive legitimacy to the court taking that case. And of course, the affirmative action cases are just two of many cases the court didn't have to take. They reached out to take. And as you say, they're going to disturb, you know, almost five decades of doctrine in order to reverse it. And so I think we're on the horns, and I say we very broadly, meaning the people who cover the court for their day job, of this dilemma of how do I continue to cover this institution as though it's legitimate in the face of a million markers of illegitimacy. And different people are making up their own minds about how to do that. And maybe the coda to all this is, you know, as we're taping, there's new evidence coming out from Politico that the court was going to just, I mean, that the Trump lawyers were simply going to take the 2020 election to Clarence Thomas and thought they had him in the bag and that that was going to set aside the election. That's the kind of issue that every Supreme Court reporter should be top of mind when they're thinking about why did Ketanji Brown Jackson just recuse in the Harvard affirmative action case, and Clarence Thomas persists in not recusing in any January 6 cases. And right. We don't cover that as a Supreme Court press corps. We leave it to political reporters to cover that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you first came on my old radio show probably during the Bush years or maybe the early Obama years. I'm not sure, but I've certainly sensed a shift in your coverage of the court. I think back then you had a lot of respect for the court and saw its legitimacy as something that was valuable and worth safeguarding. And that has certainly changed. You mentioned the Supreme Court heard arguments in two cases, kind of twin cases this week, that will certainly result in affirmative action being barred from college admissions. And I should point out just for the record that the idea that race is used exclusively in college admissions is completely untrue. It's one factor among many. I don't think there's any doubt about the outcome. You wrote for Slate in a piece co-byline by Mark Joseph Stern, who is another writer we like having on the show, that they are throwing judicial restraint right out the window yet again. You wrote, and I quote, "What was perhaps most remarkable in these largely predictable arguments was how much time the conservative justices devoted to pure policy arguments. These justices dislike affirmative action for a whole lot of deep emotional reasons that, it turns out, have nothing to do with the Constitution." Can you kind of walk us through a few examples of those kinds of arguments that are not related to the Constitution?
Well, maybe the best way to do that is to just compare it to oral arguments and the decision in Bruin, which was the gun case last year, right? Where the court was so wedded to the idea of originalism and text and history and what was the original public meaning and what did contemporaneous, you know, thinkers believe and say, blah, 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 right? So they're meant to be, if the project is originalism, looking at what was the defining purpose, in this case, of the 14th Amendment or of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. And what was amazing is that the same court that in Dobbs couldn't get its head out of centuries-old doctrine and theory, in this case had seemingly no interest whatsoever in the original intent or purpose, the time of ratification, what the report said around both the 14th Amendment and Title VI. And instead, as I said, you just got a lot of vibes, right? Like, yeah. Oh, Justice Gorsuch is really not super into the fact that squash players and legacy people get spots at Harvard. You know, Clarence Thomas kept saying over and over again, "I don't even know what diversity means. Like, someone explain to me what diversity means." And, you know, Justice Alito, not to be outdone, in addition to taking a crack at Elizabeth Warren in oral arguments, just kept persisting in this kind of feelings ball sense that this is race discrimination, to use race at all. And, you know, we've seen this before. This is the new, the Constitution is quote unquote colorblind and it's race blind. And this is, you know, the way that the conservative legal movement has chosen to go after any use of race to remediate past harm. So none of this is surprising. But I guess what's surprising to me is that in the midst of all of this feelings ball, you know, all of this, like, well, I just don't like this very much. It hurts my feelings. We have Elena Kagan 2.5 hours into the first argument, the UNC argument, more or less just putting up her hand at the end and being like, anyone going to talk about originalism here? Like, maybe we should do that. And so I think that for me, that's what gives away the game, right? Is that originalism, which is meant to be the holy grail, let's figure out what the purpose was. Are we really going to have the temerity to say that the purpose of the 14th Amendment was to erase all knowledge and understanding of race and color? Okay, if you want to take that position, take it. But to just ignore it, to just pretend that we have no actual interest in what the purpose was of the Reconstruction Amendments, that to me says really that originalism is a game. It's a shell game that is used to effectuate certain outcomes when you can get them, i.e. in the guns case, and that you can completely ignore it and just talk about your feelings if originalism doesn't redound to the point you want to make. And so for me, I think it's really, you know, we can have a conversation about this 6-3 supermajority and what it's doing to precedent, what it's doing to longstanding doctrine, what it's doing to tests. But this isn't even that conversation because this is so purpose-driven. They don't even want to play by the rules of their own originalist game.
And it's distressing. I really hope that listeners understand how distressing it is to have a majority on the Supreme Court that appears unconcerned with any kind of factual record, right? A ruling, as Dahlia says, according to Vibes, right? Key to their entire argument here is that if you stop talking about racial stratification, it'll just go away, or that it already has gone away, which was also kind of the central argument in gutting the Voting Rights Act a couple of years ago. Robert said, basically, well, you don't need it anymore. And it seems antithetical to the very nature of the courts to, you know, they're supposed to create and analyze a factual record. And they've just, it seems like the big thing about the 6-3 court is that they have given up even worrying about appearances. It used to be, oh, John Roberts is, you know, concerned about safeguarding the legitimacy of the court, and therefore he's going to constrain the majority from going too far in order to preserve the legitimacy of the court. At this point, they're like, well, we're 6-3, so who cares? Dahlia, before I let you go, I want to shift gears here just for a second to give listeners a heads up about a case that could theoretically, and I don't want to seem, I know this will sound hyperbolic, could theoretically spell the end of American democracy. It's a case called Moore versus Harper. The court will hear oral arguments on it on December 7th, a day that already lives in infamy.
Yeah, good choice. Not to be hyperbolic, but yep.
What is at stake in that case?
So this is one of those cases that is so wonky and eye-glazing that, like, by the time I finish this sentence, people's ears will be on screen save. And that's really unfortunate, as you say, because I do think it is the single most consequential case that the court will hear this term. It's just not easily explained. So, you know, the short version is this is something called the independent state legislature theory or the independent state legislature doctrine. And both theory and doctrine you can put in air quotes because they don't actually exist anywhere outside the sort of fringe conservative legal academy. And I should note, we're seeing amicus briefs now coming in from serious lifelong conservative thinkers disavowing this theory. In other words, this is not a right-left proposition. This is a right versus bonkers proposition.
Right.
But the gravamen of the idea is that rooted in a misreading of the Constitution and a misreading of a Rehnquist concurrence in Bush v. Gore that only got 3 votes, right? So this was not the majority opinion or the plurality opinion in Bush v. Gore, but an idea that then Chief Justice Rehnquist floated in Bush v. Gore is now being held out as a piece of doctrine that says essentially this: the Constitution gives state legislatures plenary unreviewable power to set every single thing to do with elections, and it cannot be reviewed by even state courts under the state constitution, and it cannot be touched by, you know, state governors or other state executive actors. So in effect, what they're saying is that if a state legislature, and think about, you know, 30 of the 50 states are red state legislatures right now, just decide that they're okay with election suppression, or they're okay with doing away with drop boxes, or doing away with, you know, souls to the polls or other mechanisms for early voting, that is unreviewable by any court. It is unreviewable. It can't be corrected by other arms of the state. And that state legislatures, which are creations of state constitutions, not vice versa, right, are independent entities that exist outside of any check. And what that means in the shortest possible version, and this is an extreme reading of it, and there's one that's rooted in, you know, the Elections Clause and the Electors Clause of the Constitution, but the very simple sort of back of the envelope argument is that the thing that Donald Trump and John Eastman were urging Brad Raffensperger to do in Georgia, just give us a slate of fake electors, just set aside what the electorate wanted and just make it up. The state legislature has complete plenary unreviewable power to do just that. And it's a chilling case, not just because we have so many, you know, legislatures that are completely in the control of one party that doesn't even believe in elections, as we're hearing now going into the midterms, but it really does mean that the Supreme Court going forward will be the sole arbiter of what state legislatures can and can't do, because state courts have no control. It's not an accident in this case that state Supreme Court chief justices have all filed a brief, regardless of partisan affiliation, saying this is unconscionable. And, right, you know, people like Mike Luttig, who are the bulwark between the 2020 election and, you know, the overturning of that election, are on fire, as you say, about this case. A lifelong conservative saying essentially this will mean the end of free and fair elections if it's blessed by the court.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there was a time when you would think, oh, here we have a number of conservative legal heavy hitters warning that a finding that legislatures aren't checked or balanced will fundamentally change our system of government. You would think at an earlier era that that would be a bridge too far, even for a conservative court. But I don't know that we can be confident about things like that at this point with this court.
Well, we've had four of the five very conservative members of this court have already signed off on some iteration of this theory, just in either the run-up to the 2020 election or the run-up to this particular North Carolina case. So we are essentially way past that point. We have four of the five, we haven't heard from Amy Coney Barrett on this issue, already willing to take this seriously as a constitutional proposition.
And on that terrifying note, Dahlia Lithwick, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're super, super busy these days, and I really do appreciate your offering your time.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Folks, Dahlia's book is called Lady Justice, Women, the Law, and the Battle to Save America. I got myself a copy, and you should too. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and come right back.
The Lace Lady, travel with Grace, baby. I can't afford to cover the course. Of course, maybe settle that one in court, because judging by the basics, y'all already comfortable, stuck up in the matrix. Shit is basic, patch credentials, but understand your favorite rapper, peep my gold potential. I'm out of shame, been passive, trying to fit the circle, cause I don't know how to act shit. Half of y'all was steady, insecure, don't try to backflip, just because the seasoning and flow's already active. Only 4 years, fantastic, young veteran, new classic. Nah, knock the walls off, fuck the whole key, we gon' hinge the whole door off. I'm still AD, never forget it. It's life after death, roll the credits.
Welcome back. I remain Joshua Holland, and I'm happy to welcome Jonathan Levinson to the show. Jonathan is a multimedia reporter covering policing for Oregon Public Broadcasting. Jonathan, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thanks for having me.
thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. So Portland has become a flashpoint, certainly during the racial justice protests of 2020. Clashes between protesters and police were played on a loop on Fox News and other conservative media. Donald Trump and other prominent right wingers constantly kind of like referenced Portland, your conservative uncle. And most conservatives are probably convinced that large swaths of Portland were burned to the ground. And this supposed conflagration is used today to justify the January 6th insurrection and to support the claim that the insurrectionists are being prosecuted for their politics rather than their actions. But now, according to a newly unredacted internal report by the Department of Homeland Security, we have learned, or we have evidence of what I think a lot of people suspected at the time, which was that law enforcement's response to those protests were heavily politicized and in a way to advance that whole storyline. Jonathan has a piece in at Oregon Public Broadcasting about this very thing. This report was originally released with so many blacked out passages that we didn't really know what it said until the department relented under pressure from Senator Ron Wyden and others to release a unredacted version. So what did we learn when they did that, Jonathan?
We learned a few things. So we knew from the previous report that intelligence had been politicized, that there had been attempts to insert things like referring to protesters as violent Antifa anarchists. We learned the specific names of which officials were trying to do the politicization. We learned that, you know, Acting Secretary of Homeland Security at the time, Chad Wolf, and Acting Deputy Secretary Ken Cuccinelli were leading those efforts. We know that they wanted the Office of Intelligence Analysis to create what are called operational background reports. They are colloquially referred to as baseball cards. They wanted them to create these reports on every person who attended protests, right? That could be, I mean, on some nights in July, that was several thousand people. And that was motivated by a belief that there was one person who was funding these protests, this idea that there was a mastermind behind it. Ultimately, those reports weren't created on every single attendee. They were compiled on people who were arrested at the protests. And these reports consisted of things like past criminal history, travel history, what DHS called derogatory information. They combed through social media. Initially, they included things like people's friends lists on social media, although those got pulled from the final reports. But we do know now that the reports included some people's social media posts, which this report says is actually First Amendment protected speech. And so whether or not it's actually legal to collect that information, sort of pushing into a gray area at a minimum. Those are the big takeaways. We learned some other, you know, interesting details that as the agency was ramping up and surging analysts into, like, you know, Portland and Seattle and Minneapolis, they were so short on equipment that they were going to Best Buy to buy computers and sort of dishing them out in the parking lot, which
I really love that, like, detail. Sometimes these reports just have these little details, and this one is great. I'll quote, "A scramble purchase for laptops was made through acquisitions from Best Buy, and on a Saturday evening, the new hires were asked to meet in the DHS Nebraska Avenue complex parking lot so they could pick up a collection laptop." It's remarkable. This was the intelligence side of this operation. There were all these different federal agencies that were sent to Portland. There was the other side of it, and I just want to touch on this. They flooded the zone with these federal law enforcement from a variety of agencies, and you wrote they had limited training in crowd control, their violent tactics, and the popular resistance they sparked fed a Trump administration narrative that Portland was under siege by what the administration routinely characterized as violent Antifa terrorists. Let me just note, this is something that I've seen when I've covered a lot of protests over my career, whatever. And I remember when I covered the Occupy Wall Street protests in Oakland, California, several years back, this dynamic was very clear. You could have like a largely peaceful protest that was tense with people who were angry, and police could turn that chaotic very quickly with overly aggressive and especially seemingly arbitrary crowd control. I remember I wrote about this at the time. There was a march and they kept like just blocking various streets for no reason and letting people go some streets and others they wouldn't. So then they turn around, they tell reporters that the protesters were violent. Most journalists are not skeptical of those claims. Anyway, as you say, there was this push to identify a single individual or group with this that was masterminding these attacks. Jonathan, who is Brian Murphy and what role did he play in all of this?
Brian Murphy was at the time the acting undersecretary for intelligence and analysis, and that's the DHS agency that does intelligence collection and analysis. and he was one of these leaders who was politicizing the intelligence from what this report says. He pushed this idea that the protesters were all Antifa and wanted the collection, the reports to reflect that, right? So he wanted his subordinates to call the protesters violent Antifa anarchist inspired, or VAAI, as the report said. He got pushback from his subordinates, from these collectors, who said, you know, our intelligence doesn't reflect that. But they basically forced it through anyway in order to make the intelligence comply with their political beliefs. One of the general counsel in DHS thought this was so egregious that he actually wanted it reported to the Director of National Intelligence as a questionable intelligence activity. It's not clear if that ever happened or not, but this was clearly an attempt to force their political views into the intelligence collection and the reports that were being sent up the chain.
The reason I bring up Brian Murphy is because, you know, the report makes it clear that he was looking to twist the intelligence, as you say, to make it consistent with Trump's rhetoric about Portland. But there's an interesting twist here, because 6 or so months later, in September of 2020, Murphy would file a whistleblower report himself, accusing Chad Wolf, then DHS secretary, and his deputy Ken Cuccinelli of ordering him to, and I'm going to quote from the New York Times, modify intelligence assessments to ensure that they matched up with the public comments by President Trump and the subject of Antifa and anarchist groups. So I found this a really interesting detail, right? Here's this guy's totally blasted in the report, and then he turned around and filed a whistleblower report. By the way, in that whistleblower report, he also said that they wanted him to underplay or stop talking about Russian interference in U.S. politics. Jonathan, do you think his whistleblower report was a CYA thing?
You know, I'm going to defer to people who have probably covered that more closely than I have. My reporting has really been focused on what happened in Portland, and I don't know enough to opine on that.
Okay, but it's just fascinating that, like, here's this internal DHS report saying this guy was, like, pushing everybody to twist the intelligence, and then he turns around and says, well, no, it's my bosses who are pushing me to twist the intelligence. So just something that listeners should know. Jonathan, let me ask you before we go on, did Portland burn to the ground?
No, Portland definitely did not burn to the ground. You know, it's, I guess even reading my own coverage, people outside of Portland could be forgiven for thinking that. But no, the protests were certainly massive, very dramatic, and at times extraordinarily violent. But it was mostly isolated to a few blocks downtown. And I don't think there's any reason to believe that the boarded up businesses and issues with, you know, economic issues downtown had anything to do with the protests. It was very much COVID related, and downtown is now once again opening up and a fairly vibrant place. And,
I try to get to Portland. I usually get out to Portland every year because I have very old friends who live there, and I love Portland. First of all, I love the donuts, very good donuts. The food is great. I love Portland, just a great time. And
it's a good city.
It is a good city. It's a totally cool city. And I several times we've gone to the coast, which is gorgeous. Okay, so I want to ask you a little bit more about the kind of perspective here, just to put this story into a larger context. State and local law enforcement responded to the protests in a similar way as the feds. Is that right? Can you talk a little bit about, you wrote about an audit of the Portland Police Bureau's intelligence gathering, and you've also written about some of the lawsuits for police violence that have followed in the wake of those protests.
The Portland Police Bureau basically led protest response the entire like 200 some odd days, except for the month of July, when it was, all the protests were focused on the federal courthouse and federal law enforcement. So every other night, you know, the end of May, all of June, August, lots of September, the Portland Police Bureau was the lead agency. There were times when they got assistance from neighboring jurisdictions, whether that's the Oregon State Police or sometimes the sheriff's office. But yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinarily violent time. Like you said, there are often these largely peaceful protests, as we have come to so often refer to them. And the police respond to provocations from the crowd with violence, with less lethal munitions, with tear gas, with once there were limitations placed on their use of tear gas, it became some nights like hand-to-hand combat. It was stunning to see. They're in a position where the protesters are intentionally provoking them. There are some people in the crowd who are throwing things, who are committing, whether it's acts of violence or vandalism, and the only response they have is either to sit back and do nothing, or to charge into the crowd and do what we saw night after night. And I think, depending on who you talk to, neither of those solutions is really palatable. But it was a pretty alarming to witness.
I want to add that Portland has also been the target of various right-wing street fighting groups who come in from out of town, Proud Boys and the like, to scrap with leftists, with Rose City Antifa and others. And I think that it's, none of this should be surprising, given how, and I hate using the word polarized, but given how, you know, law enforcement in this country tends to be very conservative. Portland is famously not. Law enforcement across the country did not take calls for accountability well around the Black Lives Matter protests. And, we have people screaming about teachers being vaguely liberal, but teachers aren't armed and they don't have qualified immunity and they aren't trained in violence. And our police forces are heavily politicized. And the reason that that's a big problem, aside from the obvious, I think, is that they consume the same conservative media and embrace the same kind of conspiracism as others on the right. And we see that here with the idea that there was some all-powerful, murky, shadowy group, Antifa terrorists, behind all of this when, and Jonathan, you can disagree with me, but my take is that you had, you know, large protests that were basically, you know, liberal normies, and then there were some instigators within that. So there was times when you saw moms, like there was a moms group out in front of the federal federal courthouse. So, you know, I think we need to really take a hard look at how politics influences policing in this country.
Yeah, I mean, I think my response to that is, and sort of building off of what I was saying earlier, is that it's kind of hard to suss out to what extent these were provocateurs in the crowd and to what extent the police presence was itself the provocation.
Right.
People have and are debating that at length.
Sure.
It's the same debate that is ongoing about the police role in mental health crises, right? Where their simple presence of a person in uniform with a gun is itself an escalation, and what role does that play? So I don't know that there's a solid answer, but you are certainly correct that every night I was out there, it was hundreds and hundreds of peaceful protesters making their voices heard. And to the extent that there were people in the crowd doing other things, it was a very small number.
Jonathan Levinson, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today and for sharing your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
I'd also like to thank Dahlia Lithwick and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. You can follow me on Twitter for the moment. I also set up at Mastodon, and I think it's just Joshua Holland, and at Counter Social, although I don't know if those are going to take off. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternate and Raw Story for supporting the show. Make sure to get one or two or three or four or five people who may not vote. Try to encourage them to get out to the polls. And I want to thank all of you folks for tuning in. Have a terrific week.